today by the New York Mets. Final score up at Miller Park was 5-0. The Cubs, they had the day off. The White Sox lost to Baltimore 9-3. Today game for the Cubs and the Giants down at Wrigley. Then tonight the Brewers host the Mets again up at Miller Park. And the White Sox meet the Tigers on the road in Detroit. Over in the NBA, the playoffs, Houston beat Golden State 98-94, so they go up 3-2 in their series. Over in the Eastern Conference, tonight, Boston plays in Cleveland. The Celtics currently own a 3-2 series lead over Cleveland. Now the forecast from the National Weather Service, a sunny morning, but a partly sunny afternoon, a high of 88. 40% chance of rain tonight, a low dropping back to 63. Quick check on the holiday weekend. It's going to be sunny and hot all 3 days. Saturday, 88. Sunday, 93. Monday, Memorial Day, 85. Sunshine this morning. Wind from the southwest at 8. Currently 75 in Racine, 73 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack Andrea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Last Friday night, I had quite an extraordinary experience, and I'm very excited to be able to have the opportunity to talk about it today on the morning show with the man largely responsible for that remarkable experience, Dr. Jonathan Shaler, professor of communications at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. Dr. Shaler, as I'm sure many of you know, has overseen for many years the Shakespeare Prison Project at the Racine Correctional Institution, overseeing a number of Shakespeare productions over the years with inmates as the cast. And we've had conversations about this repeatedly over the years, but this was the first opportunity that I have had to actually see for myself what Dr. Shaler has been talking about with such passion and enthusiasm over these many years. I think at least once before I have been invited, but it was not possible. But in this particular case, it was possible for me to accept Dr. Shaler's invitation to attend this this performance. And I was, to put it simply, floored. It was an extraordinary production, and performance, and more than that, just profoundly moving to see all of this come together. And so I invited Dr. Shaler to come on the morning show for kind of an update of his Shakespeare Prison project and for us to talk together about what I witnessed last Friday night, a production, a performance of Shakespeare's rather seldom produced play, Cymbeline. And Dr. Shaler, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks so much, Greg. It's wonderful to be here again, and it's wonderful that you finally got to see the men performing one of these plays.
Yeah, and I was going to wait till we got to this point, but I think I just have to say it right off the bat. I've been trying to figure out how to put into words what my feelings were going in terms of my sense of anticipation. It is not exactly that I was skeptical. I mean, it's not that I've thought over all these years that you were somehow, you know, misleading me and the public about what was going on there. I mean, I believed you, and yet it was just sort of hard to take in the possibility of prison inmates, many of whom have never acted in Shakespeare before, some perhaps never acted in anything before, being able to put on an effective, even plausible performance of a Shakespeare play within a prison. I mean, in a room not designed for theater. I mean, they're just all sorts of things that just sort of make you wonder, how can this possibly be true? So I guess maybe that is skepticism. I don't know. But what I really expected, I guess, was that I was going to see something that was earnest and a valiant effort, which I was certain I would deeply appreciate and find moving. But more in the way that one goes to a middle school band concert, and and you're listening to young musicians grappling with these still unfamiliar instruments and trying their best to play the opening theme of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. But you know, you have no expectations that you're going to hear glorious music making. You're going to just you're there to support these valiant young musicians doing the best they can. That's more like what I thought I was going to experience, and I hope that's not insulting to you.
Not at all.
And in fact, that is not what I expected, or
so
that is not what I experienced.
What did you experience, Greg?
instead, I experienced a really fine performance of this Shakespeare play, Cymbeline. I was really astounded that their acting was so strong, and certain performers really superb, and even those performers who clearly were less experienced or maybe a little bit less assured, everybody was absolutely fine. I mean, there was nobody that was, in a sense, a distraction or a hindrance to the performance. It was extremely impressive, and it was only when I realized how impressed I was that I realized sort of the depth of my skepticism going in. I mean, that what I expected it to be and what it turned out to be were just poles apart. And I suspect I'm not the first person who has come to a performance like this and had a similar experience.
That's true. And for our audience, it's probably helpful to clarify that this was spoken in the original Shakespearean language. It was not updated or modified. But we did have to cut the play. The original run would be over 3 hours, and we simply didn't have that much time. So we came in at 2.5 hours, but that's a solid 2.5 hours without intermission. And I think we kept the audience's attention. And I know some people will make jokes about a captive audience, but I've heard that one before. But it really it was clear that the audience was engaged. One of our audience members was a guest that I invited, who I consulted with through the year, Valerie Wayne, who's the editor of the Third Arden edition of Cymbeline. And that is the premier scholarly edition of Shakespeare's works and the latest edition of the play. We got some feedback from her, and if I could just quote briefly from a longer letter that she wrote to us. She says, "There's a kind of alchemy that happens when theater works. And the actors at RCI created that magic on both nights." She went to two performances. "Although they had no stage sets or major props except for the trunk, they brought the powers of language and gesture to their performances. Cymbeline's language is complicated, but they spoke it with such clarity that the audience could follow all the twists and turns of a complicated plot. When Iacomo stepped stealthily out of the trunk, there was an audible surprise from those watching. When Cymbeline asked in the last scene, "Does the world go round?" he got a big laugh each night. There were other laughs in the right places and no laughs where they were not welcome. The battle scenes were forceful and exciting. The audience was with this show at each step of the way because your actors were so good. They memorized challenging lines, stepped into their roles, and brought a powerful story to life before our eyes. As the editor of the Arden Shakespeare edition of Cymbeline, I had already seen 13 live productions of the play in England and North America. I had watched 8 other shows on video or film and read about many more. So I speak with some experience when I say that this production was an impressive accomplishment.
There you have it.
Nice to have it witnessed and validated.
Well, absolutely. So not just an amateur like me, but an expert like this woman.
Your opinion is highly regarded, Greg.
Well, I'm just there as an ordinary person, but as an ordinary person, I was really blown away. So it was so nice after having heard so much about this over the years to finally see the fruits of your labors with my own eyes. And So I want us to talk about kind of all that happened and a little bit about the background of this particular production.
Absolutely.
So again, we're talking about Shakespeare's Cymbeline, which is a relatively unfamiliar play, of course, compared to Macbeth or Hamlet or Romeo and Juliet and so on. At what point did you choose Cymbeline for a performance at this time and why?
Our rhythm has developed so that once we finish a year's work, we want something to look forward to, and so we immediately make a decision about what our next play will be. And I had a short list of plays that the men were looking at, about 12, and they were doing some research on it, talking about it on the yard, and then that's what we did last year, and we did again this year. So with Cymbeline, I walked them through a decision tree, and it began with the question, do you want to laugh? Do you want to cry? Do you want to watch men fight with swords? Or do you want all of the above? And they said all of the above. Mm. And Cymbeline was on the short list of plays that has everything but the kitchen sink in it.
In fact, the woman who you quoted when we were chatting, she said that probably one of the reasons it's not done all that much is because it is such a striking mix of art, heartbreaking and funny, and that probably some people find that maybe either a little off-putting or a little disconcerting. Mm-hmm. I mean, they just prefer their theater to be either straight funny or straight sad, but it is a striking mix of both.
It is.
And so for maybe for some people, that makes them a little wary of Cymbeline. It's a play she loves. Mm-hmm. It's a play I loved. Mm-hmm. I'd never seen it before. But one of the things that is interesting to me is that this is then, in a sense, a long haul once you have chosen a play. Talk us through what the essential time arc is.
Yes.
I mean, from choice of play to the first performance.
Right. Well, thanks for asking, because that's really important. The play itself is a wonderful culmination of an 8-month, longer than that actually, but essentially an 8-month experience where in September, typically we begin with acting exercises, reading the play, developing an ensemble, studying the play, writing journal assignments that are reflections on the character. We write backstories for the characters, really delve into the psychology of the characters and their choices, and do a lot of improvisational work, get men comfortable expressing themselves and being flexible and working with one another. It takes a long time to go through that. Not everybody completes the journey. So this year we began with 16 and we ended up with 11. Sometimes we begin with 20 and end up with 17. It varies from year to year. But that 8-month arc goes from September to May, and now you just saw the performances. We do 3 performances, 2 for in the evenings. They're for everybody, but 2 are in the evenings and 1 is a matinee. We started doing a matinee last year, I believe, because it gives – or 2 years ago – because it gives staff an opportunity to see the play. The officers are, of course, always there to enforce security, but staff are largely out of the institution by the evening, so only inmates would have the opportunity to see the shows. So we definitely want staff to have the opportunity to see it. And we've gotten wonderful responses, warm responses, and appreciative responses from staff, which is so important and so meaningful. But then after this, we continue to meet.
After performances are done.
Yeah, so we just yesterday, in fact, we had a wrap-up where it's one of the most significant parts of the process for me. It really tells me how we've done, because the guys sit in a circle, they look at each other, and they reflect on what they've accomplished. And to hear them celebrate each other is just so wonderful. Mm. To hear them in very specific and telling ways, no BS, talk about where we started and what challenges we faced and how we got to where we are now. There was one guy who played Pisanio, for example, who was very quiet, almost withdrawn, and had a hard time coming out of his shell at first. And he worked over that year to develop his posture, his ability to project his voice, his ability to look people in the eye, his ability to laugh at himself and with others. And he just opened up like a flower. And I think that was a beautiful example of what can happen. And the fact that I'm not the one who made that observation, the other men made that observation. So
they saw that.
Yeah, they saw
that.
And
they weren't afraid to say that either.
That's right. That's right. So to see good and to appreciate that and validate that and help people along on their journey is so much about what this project is. Now we're going to go into the next phase of the project, which is through the summer, at least half of the summer, and that's called Shakespeare's Mirror. This is where the men write their own personal stories that are inspired by their work with Cymbeline. So it might be a line, it might be a character, it might be a theme in the play that has sparked some memory or some thought, some reflection about their own lives. They are going to develop those stories. We're going to help them. We're going to make it a performance. And then we present that in the institution. This year it's going to be in the middle of July. After that, we go right into workshop mode and recruiting new members for the next season, which will begin the first week in September. And you didn't ask, but I will tell you that next season they've already chosen the play, and it's Measure for Measure, which is a wonderful play, another less often produced play, but it's one of Shakespeare's problem plays, and it deals with, as you may know, a duke who abdicates for a while so that he can test out a young officer, Angelo, in his position and see what happens when Angelo comes in to enforce the laws a little more strictly. So there's a lot of justice issues and interesting themes in that play.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Dr. Jonathan Shaler, who not only is on the faculty at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, but also head of the Shakespeare Prison Project. And we are talking about a performance that I was privileged to witness this past Friday night of Shakespeare's Cymbeline within the walls of the Racine Correctional Institution. Let's talk for a moment about the very start of the process and the gathering of men to be part of this. So, for instance, the men that I saw in this performance of Cymbeline, at what point did they become cast? And is this a situation in which more men express interest than can be used? Or are there some men who, for whatever reason, don't seem to be right to be appropriate choices to be part of a project like this? I mean, how does that selection process work?
As long as the person who wants to be a part of this adheres to our basic guidelines, which is respect for one another, holding yourself accountable and being responsible, coming to rehearsals on time, staying throughout rehearsals, and doing the work, you know, we're really open to everybody. So you have to, I think, at some level be able to read and memorize lines. That seems to be fundamental. And that's about it. And so we welcome everyone. And what happens is that men self-select out when they find that they can't meet the commitment, either the time commitment. That's sometimes an issue. It's just too much time. We meet every Tuesday and Thursday night from 6 to 8:30 p.m. during the regular season, September through May. And that's a big commitment. And they have a lot of them have other programming that they have to do. So some of them can't manage that, and they figure that out in the first few weeks. But then sometimes people just figure out that it's not for them. It's very rare, I think, in the years that we've done this, that I've had to ask somebody to leave. I can think of one person who wanted to stay but wasn't working out. Mm-hmm. And it was a respect issue. It was an attitude issue. And so we had a meeting, a one-on-one discussion and a goodbye. And so that's how that worked, yeah.
Nice, though, that that's been such a rare occurrence. Mm-hmm. So, I touched on the fact that the performance I saw featured at least some men who have scant theatrical experience and certainly no experience whatsoever in performing in Shakespeare. I wonder if you could maybe summarize that a little more cleanly and clearly for us. Mm-hmm. I mean, of the men I saw performing Cymbeline the other night, how many of them, I mean, already before you came along, had some resume of theatrical experience of any significance at all, and versus how many were complete newcomers?
Well, several of them built their resume through the Shakespeare Prison Project.
Right, right.
Beginning with either The Tempest or Hamlet years ago, and coming back year after year and developing their skills. Most of them have had close to zero experience acting at all.
Before prison.
Correct. I can think of in the current cast people who've had significant acting experience, two, maybe, of the whole cast. And, I'm not sure if that answers your question.
No, it does.
Yeah.
And I should think that's an interesting challenge for you as the director then, in opening up to them a work like Cymbeline, when I should think in other settings you might be accustomed to working with actors who come to you with at least a bit more experience and background.
Well, I mean, I used to be a high school drama director, so in some ways it's not that different because, you know, at that level you've got people coming in with no experience as well. But I have some tools to help people start from zero, and I think that's kind of exciting, actually. That's part of what I most enjoy about the work is opening people's minds and hearts to the wonder of Shakespeare and their own ability to speak the language and the power that holds and the enjoyment of that and the discovery, ongoing discovery that's involved in doing that. One method that I use is out of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. Scott Kaiser is their voice coach, and he developed a wonderful method that he calls complex orchestration, which is just a very simple step-by-step process of working through lines. Identify a speech measure, which is like a beat, a single thought or action in a speech. Then identify the focal point, who or what you're focusing on and looking at. What image are you seeing in your mind's eye? Are you looking at a place, a person, and how do you see it psychologically? That informs your action. What is the key word in that line that gets the emphasis? That's a long-standing practice in acting, period, but I think in particularly acting Shakespeare to help bring a line into focus and to make it very clear in its delivery. There's always a single word that line hinges on. Hmm. And so on. I won't break it all down for you, but that's one method. Then we've also worked with Shakespeare with veterans. It's called Feast of Crispian in Milwaukee. They do a method. They use a method called feeding and dropping, which they picked up from a workshop in Massachusetts. And the feeding and dropping method is one where you have the actor stand on stage, you introduce the scene and the character to the actor. They have no book in their hands, so any fear of text or reading is out the window. They are fed the first line, and it could just be a couple of words or part of a line, something easily heard and understood and repeated. They're fed that line, and they simply repeat it. Then a suggestion or a question is posited by the acting coach. When was the last time you were angry at someone? Or when was the last time you felt misunderstood? And so on. And then the actor does not start talking about that. The actor just hears the question. And then right away the coach repeats the line, and the actor repeats the line. And Nancy Smith Watson, who's one of the founders of Shakespeare with Veterans, says that it's like, in a way, it's like a barrel full of monkeys. You dip that one monkey down with the hooked arm, and you may or may not hook something when you do that deep dive. That's what the dropping is, that aspect of the process. But it is a way of getting people immediately speaking Shakespeare's language and seeing a connection to their own emotional life very quickly.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. What about the matter of Shakespeare? Now, this is not true for someone like you, so steeped in Shakespeare, but for most of the rest of us, when we open up a Shakespeare script or hear it spoken, it's hard for us to understand what it means on that most basic level, not even on the more profound level, but just what does that mean, the archaic language?
Mm.
How difficult is it to kind of get through that aspect of this with the men? And, when you are first actually working on Cymbeline, how much of your time is taken up just clarifying, that's what this sentence means, that's what this sentence means,
mm-hmm.
that's what this sentence means.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as opposed to if you were doing Death of a Salesman, in which
right.
there would not be that barrier of archaic language.
Right. Well, we do use annotated editions, so they have the heavy notes in whatever edition they're using. We used Folger last year. We're going to use the Arden edition of Measure for Measure this year. When I say we use the Folger, we certainly also consulted the Arden. I want mm-hmm. Valerie to know that, if she knows that. But back to your question of how we work through the language. Yeah, we do a lot of what does this word mean? What does this line mean? We make sure that everybody understands every word and every line. And, Shakespeare's language sounds daunting at first, but once you get used to it,
right.
it's that fear factor is a lot of why people say they can't understand Shakespeare, because they're fogging it with their extra anxiety. If I said to you, be absolute for death, is there any question about what I mean? I don't. To me, it's very clear that I'm saying, set your mind and your heart, you're gonna die.
Mm.
Yeah, that's a line I happen to know from Measure for Measure.
Okay,
but or how about this one, which is one that often comes to mind at the end of a season? You do look, my son, in a moved sort, as if you were dismayed. Be cheerful, sir. Our revels now are ended. These are actors, as I foretold you, are all spirits, and are melted into air, into thin air. And like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea, all which it inherit, shall dissolve. And like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep. Just had to work in a little Shakespeare.
Well, and of course that's the beauty of language when it's wielded like that, is that it also stays with us
mm-hmm.
so beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
So you worked with these men over the course of a number of months. At some point, evidently somebody faded from the cast, because at some point you became an actor. Just say a word about that.
That was something, yes. So, and it relates to casting. I kind of unintentionally evaded that question that came up earlier. How do we do casting? So it's a mix of men being interested in particular roles, being drawn to particular roles, auditioning for particular roles, and then me having to sort it out at the end, really, because not everybody can play the lead or not everybody can have that juicy comic role, although several might be attracted to it. So, you know, we do have to sort it out at some point. And what I find is fascinating, and my other colleagues who do Shakespeare in Prison have said similar things, is that the roles seem to find the men.
Hmm.
Meaning that by the end of the season, it's hard to imagine the people who are in the roles that they are, that anybody else could have played these roles any better in the company. And in fact, there was a reason for them to be in those roles. It touched them. I'll just give you one example. We have one man who has openly discussed in session, and this is what happens in our circle work. We sit in a circle and we talk about the play, the themes, how they relate to our lives. And he revealed late in the process that he is diagnosed schizophrenic. Mm. And he played a character who was originally two characters, and we combined into one.
Hmm.
This was the First Lord and the Second Lord who waits on Clotten. And the First Lord, as written, is somebody who's very much a sycophant who panders to Clotten, who kisses up to him. And then the Second Lord is somebody who turns to the audience and makes jokes at Clotten's expense, like, he really isn't all that, and can you believe this guy, kind of thing. Kind of the good guy and the bad guy, the good servant and the bad servant, if you want to put it bleakly. And what this actor told us was that growing up, he was under a lot of pressure to be the good guy.
Hmm.
And then a bad guy kind of emerged, with a different name. And he was split that way himself growing up. And it attributes a lot of his difficulty and his criminal activity to that confusion. That split. So when I had no idea of any of this history, and he didn't mention it to me when we assigned the roles, but he worked through that, we found out, and found that although it was frightening to him at first and challenging because it reminded him of his own condition, he saw that it's possible to be one person and to have two radically different impulses, and you don't have to literally split into two people in order for that to be a fact. And that was part of his journey in doing this. So you also asked another question that was related to
step in, as imaging.
Yeah, and how did this? If I'm going to talk about the other cast members in this way, then you know. What is this role? How was I called to this role? So we did have somebody in mind early on for the role of Imogen, which is the lead female character, because it's a very significant role and difficult to play. About 416 lines, not that we're counting. So we had somebody all lined up, and he started the year with us and then found that his programming and the weight of his other obligations was just not going to make it possible. And he wasn't going to fool himself or us by trying to start this and not finish it. So
we should clarify that by programming, we're talking about some of the other things that prisoners are asked to do.
There's early release programming. There's sex offender treatment programming. There's all kinds of things that the people are involved in. basic education programs, remedial reading and writing, all kinds of stuff. So he couldn't do it. We had to do a cast juggle at that point and shift people around in order to cover the space. And we got another actor who was quite good in the role of Imogen, and he did that for months, like 6 months.
Mm.
He worked at that role and did a fantastic job, but then he got transferred to another institution.
Mm.
And it was a no-brainer, because sometimes we ask if somebody cannot be transferred, if they can be held, but he really needed to do this in order to get early release. So that took precedence. Then we were in trouble, because now we only had a couple of months to go. And we thought about, can we actually pull this off? I mean, we have a huge hole. One of the veteran actors who I've worked with for a long time and who knows me suggested that I step into the role. And in emergency situations, I have done that in the past. And so I agreed. And I think legitimately there was some concern on the parts of some members of the cast, like, would I be able to do this? How is this going to work? You know, I won't put it starkly, but maybe I should. A 61-year-old man playing an ingenue. So
You pulled it off, yeah. I have to say. I don't know what that says about you, but
I did it.
Yeah. No, it was really something. And it was also really interesting. I mean, it brought to mind that whole question, too, of the fact that more often than not, these significant female characters are portrayed by male inmates. And it continues to astound me that that you find men who are willing to do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just seems like an exceptional step of courage to do that, and not only to just do it in the you know, within the friendly confines of a circle of colleagues with whom you're working, but then to step in front of other prisoners who are your audience, mm-hmm. and to do that. And but
we play the person, not the plumbing,
right? Okay.
I think it's an important step for as many of us to do that as possible, because it reinforces, it reminds us of our shared humanity. And so it's wonderful when people who are not immediately drawn to playing a woman's role are able and willing to step up.
Yeah. You know? That reminds me, we really haven't talked about this yet, but I have to say that something else that was very impressive to me was not just the high quality of this performance, but also the attentiveness of the inmates who were the audience that night.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really something. Now, who were those men who came, I mean, just simply of their own free
will?
I mean, really? So it was just 28 guys who wanted to see Shakespeare
up
that night?
Yeah, okay. From various units across the prison, and they were interested. Certainly we had advertising. The word was out.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them were people who knew cast members.
And I know at least one or two were past participants of the Shakespeare
That's
Prison
correct.
Project.
That's so. Right. Who you know, did their stint, and then now we're interested to see what we're still coming up with. So, yep, some of them were previous members.
Hmm.
Yeah.
It was also interesting that there were guards present,
mm.
and that at certain points in this performance, which was not in a theater, it was just in the chapel, which is not anything that looks like a church or a sanctuary. I mean, it's a
big room.
Yeah, just a very ordinary-looking room. But at several points, guards were coming in, their keys clanking, and there mm-hmm. was a gun and so on. And but it was interesting how many of them went to the back of the room and watched attentively and seemed to appreciate what was going on. But it also was kind of a stark reminder that we're in a prison.
These
are prisoners.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm reminded of that every – it's hard not to realize that every time you go in and you go through security. It's you went through it, so you know. There are many layers of security. In order, you have to be pass a background check in order to get in at all. You have to have a legitimate purpose for being there, obviously, and then there are doors to pass through. And
it's interesting to walk into that prison without anything at all, not even your own driver's license. I mean,
right? No personal belongings.
None whatsoever. Yeah. So my eyeglasses were the mm-hmm. closest, and the clothing on my back. That was it. But interesting reminders. It also occurred to me as I was watching the performance how interesting it would be for a prison inmate, for instance, to portray a king.
Mm.
I mean, a figure of tremendous authority,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
or what it would be like for these prison inmates to engage in a fight scene
mm-hmm.
with these prison guards, in the room, but, you know, to hold a weapon and to look
intense. Yeah,
and it's just interesting to think about.
Those weren't real weapons, by the way. Those were cardboard swords and one dagger made of cardboard.
Right, yes. Right. But it was interesting how effective it was. But it just kind of makes you realize that beyond some of the other aspects of this that are undeniably positive is also one that I just hadn't thought of. But what a precious opportunity it must be for these men to be able to step out of the constricted role that is theirs 24/7 pretty much, to step out of that and in a sense for a short time to no longer be a prison inmate but to be a king.
Yes, and not to be too cute, but I really believe this. I believe people who are in prison are not only people who are behind bars, but people who live constricted lives, people who are the prisoners of ideologies, limiting ideologies and behavior patterns and thinking patterns. So I say this because I believe Shakespeare has the same to offer all of us, whether we're behind bars or not. And that's why I feel like with honesty and integrity and not a sense of patronizing, I can bring this work to the men because I get so much out of it too. And, you know, we work with the Jungian archetypes and the idea of these universal trans-historical, trans-cultural roles that human beings play, sovereigns, kings, queens, warriors, lovers, magicians, sages, that kind of thing, tricksters. And for us to tap into those archetypes and to realize that we can all live that large in a sense, and we're all part of the larger human story. So I think that is a valuable part of it too.
How much do you know about the stories of these various men and why they are there?
I don't really want to know too much. I mean, unless they choose to share in our circle, and there has been some sharing, but that's one of the again one of the benefits of working with Shakespeare. It's not a program in the sense of we're going to find what's wrong with you and fix it, or and I think a lot of correctional programming has come a long way. So I don't mean to caricature it in that way, although. Can be, I guess that can happen. But there is something our volunteer coordinator was talking about just yesterday called motivational interviewing, where you ask questions and you, through a question and answer sequence, you lead someone to figuring out their own solutions, basically. with Shakespeare, we're not doing motivational interviewing. We're not doing therapy. We're not doing any kind of correctional program specifically. What we are doing is offering an opportunity for constructive teamwork through expanding one's vocabulary, through problem solving, flexibility, pro-social skills, communication skills, that sort of thing. All very important. And then if it does touch something inside one of the actors in terms of relating it very specifically to something in their own life, they can either just feel that and bring that into their performance or meditate on it in the privacy of their own space, or they can talk about it, and some choose to talk about it. So you asked, how much do I know? As much as they care to share.
What is it like for some of these men when this experience draws to a close? I know of at least one, and I'm pretty sure there's more than one of these gentlemen who I saw in Cymbeline where this was it for them, that for whatever reason they're approaching release or for some other reason it looks like this is it.
This is a big transition year for us. We're losing a lot of our veterans, really accomplished actors, I would say, and also team leaders. And so what is going to happen next? Well, one of them is applying to the theater arts program at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside and potentially could begin classes in September. which would really be something.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. I think we'll see how that goes. A couple of others I know are soon to be released and are eager to continue acting to find opportunities for that. I'm not sure what their specific job plans are, but we always mention, in case anybody has unrealistic expectations, that you don't, if you want money, sorry, theater majors out there or theater professionals, but for most of us, if you want a sustainable life, you don't start full-time as an actor.
Right.
or believe that that's, going to necessarily happen for you.
Right, yeah. Right. But I should think for a program that is this meaningful, that has to be part of it that is probably hard for you.
The end, the transition, yeah. The loss, yes. All of that, and for the guys who remain as well. So yeah, it's there's a real passing this year with losing so many veterans who've really made such big contributions. Yeah, but it's also exciting because it's an opportunity now to reach out to new members of the population and wake up the spirit in them.
So the next season with your Shakespeare Prison project with Measure for Measure, when will that begin?
The first week in September. But we will begin recruiting and doing workshops, I think, mid-July. So if everything gets approved and we get to move forward in this way, then we'll bring in the Shakespeare with Veterans people again and have them do a workshop and just introduce people to the joy of working with Shakespeare. And we'll see who wants to stick with us in the coming season.
Right. Well, I want to echo the sentiment of the review that you quoted, that this was a really powerful performance, and it was revelatory, first of all, that these inmates did such a fine job. And then beyond that, it was also a reminder to me that powerful theater need not involve a lot of fancy trappings, impressive set and detailed costumes and tons of props and so on. It is amazing the kind of theatrical work that can be done in the simplest and sparest of settings, which
Absolutely.
Is what this was. So
thank you.
I commend you and all of the gentlemen who were part of this performance of Cymbeline that performed last Friday night. And I thank you again for issuing me the invitation.
You're welcome.
Dr. Jonathan Shaler, Professor of Communications at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Monday on The Morning Show, I will be rerunning my conversation with the author of a book called The Unknowns, which tells actually the story of the original unknown soldier and the decorated soldiers who bore his body back to Arlington National Cemetery. On Tuesday, Dr. Art Searge will join me for his monthly visit to the program to offer his analysis of current events, including the dramatic cancellation of the summit between President Trump and North Korea and what might be ahead for those countries. Next Wednesday, I hope you'll be able to hear my conversation with the author of a brand new book, which is already regarded as the definitive account of the disaster at Chernobyl back in 1986. A riveting book in every single respect. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, WGTD.org. Click on Talk. We want to remind you that Pulitzer Prize-winning author and historian John Meacham is at Carthage tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock, an event I am privileged to be emceeing. We'll be talking primarily about his latest book called The Soul of America, in which Mr. Meacham looks back at some of the darkest, most divided moments in our own nation's history and explores some of the ways in which we were able to arise above those bitter divisions. That's tomorrow afternoon, 2 o'clock, Siebert Chapel, an event free and open to the public. Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching, convenient evening and summer courses designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again. And that's what brings you back